Hello! Bit of shouting. Welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast with me, Sean, and on the other end of the line, it's Robbie. Robbie Britton, how you doing, Robbie?
I'm all right, Sean. I'm all right. How are you?
I'm very well. I'm sitting looking out my window. It's very rainy in Amsterdam this morning, which is not nice. I haven't run in about, I think, 6 days. Well, I did one run of half an hour a couple of days ago, but I've been knocked out with the, well, it's not, I shouldn't joke about being knocked out with the corona. Is it coronavirus?
I think that's a bit.
But I've had the worst bug. I've read it completely wrong. The corona, I don't know what it is, but basically I haven't got that virus. I've had the worst flu I think I've had in about 5 or 6 years. I've been totally knocked out, searing headaches, that sort of thing, which makes my day job, looking after a one-year-old child, incredibly difficult. It's been very hard this week.
Never before have I hated walking around.
Well, not really, no. She's not doing a lot to help me, to be honest. She's just kind of, rolling around. She's at an age now and she wants to move. She wants to walk everywhere. So that means me walking around holding her on my knees all day. So, yeah, it's been a tough week. My wife's not well. She's been in bed. So the whole house, it's been carnage. I've got to admit, it's been carnage. It's been terrible. But hey, we survived. How's life in Italy?
It's actually, the weather's been fantastic the last couple of weeks, but today it's a bit cloudy. I'm doing probably about as much running as you are, but down to different reasons. I haven't got any kind of apocalyptic flus. I've just got a knee niggle still, so I've tried a new approach now. I've been doing a lot of physio exercises in January, a couple of hours a day, and I've decided just to try running because I got fed up of doing physio exercises. Motivation wise.
How's that approach working?
Basically, the knee doesn't feel any worse, but it doesn't feel any better. So okay. I might as well be running is what my mind is saying. I might as well go out and run on it because it's not making it worse. So hopefully, I'm going to go see someone you know as well, Sarah Tunstall, this week, get another opinion.
Oh, great.
She can look at...
Okay.
I saw a physio in the UK and he's highlighted a couple of things. I've done the physio exercise. So hopefully Sarah can say, well, yes, you've corrected this imbalance and it's made zero difference. Maybe this is the problem. And I can get another diagnosis to add to my roughly 15 diagnoses I've had so far.
Yeah. But the main thing is you're back doing a little bit of jogging.
A little bit of jogging, and my heart is very pleased with it because it gets to beat at around 180 beats per minute for easy pace. So I guess that's not easy anymore, is it?
No. That's nice for your heart, though. It's getting a nice workout.
It's getting, like, it's got a good tempo.
Yeah, great. I did a race this month, actually, before I went succumbed to the dreaded flu bug. I did a little race. Yeah, it was great. Although I you know, like in a race, like it was a 10K race down in Amsterdam. And like I always, the last couple of years, usually you can judge if you're going to win, or at least you can judge if you're going to be up there and challenged. Like you can judge by what everyone else is doing around you. You can kind of listen into their breath. You can look at their face. If they're covered in spit and stuff, you pretty much know that you've got this, you know, you're the stronger runner. Well, their spit this time, yeah. It was one of the guys was completely utterly covered in spit. And I thought, to be honest, I've got this. I can win this. So I took a bit of a lead going into the third lap. I had a K to go, I had over 20 seconds advantage. So I was winning. I thought, basically, this is one.
You've got to just keep
moving. All I've got to do is keep going. Just got to keep moving, and I got this one. And this bloke, the one that I'd noticed, was breathing out of, you know, is being with all out of kilter after about one lap. It was a three-lap race. After one lap, I thought, this guy's beat. He's going to be, there's nothing to him, really. He unleashed this kick over the last K that I could not believe. And he went from sort of 20 to 30 seconds behind me to beat me by 5 or 6 seconds. And I finished the race. And he didn't, even his running style didn't look great. He looked like an athlete, but he was a bit all over the place. He wasn't that good. Didn't look as if he was much to him, but I finished, and it was the European Veterans 1500 meter champion last year, and basically just had an insane kick that completely smashed me in the last 1500. So yeah, it was great. Apart from that last kick coming in,
so I was beating in a second. 10K? What are we talking?
Well, we're talking. It was my official time, and it was 31:20 something.
All right, so you're still shifting.
I think. Yeah, so it was all right. It wasn't too bad. It was, and it was actually, well, I chatted to my coach afterwards about it, Martin Cox, and every single person in the race seemed to record the race as long. And I know that's the kind of thing people say, God, like amateurs and stuff, about, you know, it's
just, don't do that,
but mine was,
it's a good time.
Mine was quite long.
Don't besmirch your time by saying that your GPS got the extra mileage. Just be happy. You were second.
I am happy.
500 meter runner.
Yeah,
take that time.
I should have put him to bed. Well, my Garmin said it was 10.25, so it's quite, mine was quite a long way out, but I think I was having to wait. Like, it was like, you know, it was an open 10k and it's three laps, so you, by the end of the first lap, you're overtaking people. So I think it's more that I just had to weave in and out of lots of different runners on the way around.
Yeah, work on your weaving, you've got to run through people. That's the trick. Just don't deviate from your line and go straight through them.
A bit more honking as I'm going through.
Just screaming.
Damn it. Yeah. Oh, I've got to find the Dutch equivalent of track to shout out.
But I wanted to shout something, but it was definitely German, so I can't really, it's not going to help.
No. I was, I remember once in, I think it was in one of the world championships, I was watching basically a major marathon, and I thought I remembered the word, the Ethiopian word for go, which I think is something like eyes on.
I've heard this podcast. I've heard you talk about, is Amsterdam was it you were watching?
Yeah,
done
maybe,
yeah.
And I got it completely wrong. So I was shouting hello or praise be or something weird, and I was shouting to these guys and they looked at me like I was some kind of idiot. But yeah, so
keep them entertained.
If you know what to shout. Yeah, exactly, yeah.
That.
A bit of light relief at mile 30, five or whatever.
Some skinny lunatic running alongside the course shouting hello at me. Be like, oh, that's nice. Thanks, mate. Have a good day.
Yeah, thanks for the support. Yeah, so that was good. I'm glad to be back racing, and I've got a couple coming. But I had a race next weekend, an 8k. It's like one of the fastest races in the Netherlands. It's really quick and short, obviously 8k. But I think I'm still haven't started running yet, so I'm probably best not to race this weekend. And then there's the best, one of the best 10ks. If ever you have a chance to run a 10k in over here. My favourite one is called this. It's called the Squirrel Run. Or I'm probably saying it wrong. The Groot. I think it's called Groot Squirrel Run.
The Great Squirrel Run.
Yeah, but it's a place. Squirrel's a place, which in the dunes, and it's a really fast 10k. So you get last year I ran it. They had Callum. I've forgotten Callum's surname.
I'm going to say Hawkins is the one you
Hawkins,
mean.
Hawkins, that's the one. I mean, yeah. So it's nice. I saw him. I saw who else have I seen up there? John. Johnny Mellor's been over to race. I think Mo Farah's won it at some stage. So it's a pretty good race. And a lot of them New Balance guys come over to do it. So it's a pretty nice one. But I think I'm going to be absolutely blown out the back door if I'm running 31:20 and these guys are running 27 or 28 minutes. But it's all a learning experience, isn't it?
Yeah, if you're running right yourself, just compare yourself to yourself. Maybe you'll only run 10k this time and you'll take off, like 4 minutes. That's it. That's
it's a one lapper, so I can't go too far wrong on the weaving. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Depends how hard you go, isn't it, I suppose. You can add in self-inflicted weaving if you go too hard. If you're the man with spit all over your face.
Yeah. I cannot believe he looked terrible. It's the second time this has happened this year. Once was at when I did the Mont Ventoux.
I've heard that podcast as well. Yeah, it was, that made me laugh out loud, man. I was, if you haven't listened to that podcast, which one is it in? Because I was crying with laughter running around the streets of Italy. And I just,
oh God, it was so bad.
It was brilliant. Yeah. You could just see it happening. I've been there. Your co-host's laughter is just infectious, like that Chinese virus.
He looked like he was wearing board shorts, I promise you. And I thought, oh my God, this guy's never going to live with me until the top. And then, I start to crawl up the final kilometre, and there he comes in his board shorts and his long hair with a ponytail.
You've got to focus on your own running, you comedian.
Yeah.
Stop worrying about old geezers who can sprint.
Yeah,
work on your kick. We did one. We've done it a few times in Switzerland, in Martigny, and it's 8k. Yeah. They do it. They did like these nocturnes every Christmas. And I went with Ben Riddle and Sarah Tunstall. They go over and they compete, and the women race first, and the men do a race. And I was in particularly rude health before the Valencia Marathon 2019. Yeah. And I'd done it a few times. That I remember starting nice and steady and then come around and like there was a pack ahead of us of these guys in there. Cesar Costa, who's this kind of mountain running chap. And I was like Sarah was watching. She's like, sit on that group. They're a really good group. And I like, next lap, I was obviously at the front of the group, like charging for all I was worth. And on that final lap of that one, it's like eight laps. There's a geezer, same as you, like a fair chunk behind me. And I'm like, right, yeah. I'm marathon training. I don't need to like get into some kind of sprint. And suddenly he's alongside me. And like the little voice in my head's like, yeah, just sprint. You can sprint. You know you can. You're a 24-hour runner. They've all got famous kicks. And I go to go with him, but and I overrule myself and say, look, you're marathon training. Don't destroy yourself in a sprint finish. And he beats me by a second or so. And similar to you, he was miles behind. And afterwards, like, I chat to him, and turns out he was second at the Swiss 1500 meter championships that year. It's like, I'm really glad I didn't try and sprint with you. Yeah, it's like proper kicker.
Yeah, yeah.
And a similar situation, like they just that last K, he just unleashed this otherworldly kick. And like for an ultra runner, I can kick, but not at that level. I imagine I would have destroyed myself just trying.
I just can't see how people can run 20 seconds faster in a kilometre, in kilometre 10, than they can at kilometre 1. You know, I set myself out, I'm quite a metronomic. I can run, you know, set me at 3-minute Ks, I can probably manage 5 or 6 in a row without breaking down too much. But these to be able to like run a massively fast last kilometre, I don't know how these guys do it.
Like, I get it. So some people hold something back for the kick, which I think is not right, but I think the correct way of doing it is not to hold back, but to find something extra. That's how I look at it.
Yeah, exactly.
I give it everything. Yeah. And in that last
school of thought,
there is something else I find, and it's generally to do with, like, if there's someone to chase, I have to actively not chase them, rather than, like, it's like an automatic reaction to go hard after someone ahead, and it doesn't, like, they could be, like, I don't know, yeah, that's like someone who's a K ahead, and I'm thinking, or like, I don't know, 30 seconds ahead. I've got no chance of like logistically catching them, but something in my head goes,
yeah,
you should try, mate. You should probably try. Give it everything. Destroy yourself for ninth place instead of 10th. Like, what does it matter?
Yeah. 20 euros per paycheck rather than 20
sort of 10. One extra block of Gorgonzola.
So what else has been going on in the world? I guess some interesting stuff has been going on in the world running. But Wilson Kipsang's been found doping, hasn't he? Is that this month, January?
I don't know. That was I'm sad about that. I like Wilson.
It's got that kind of maybe leads on. I was chatting to some the wife of the guy who runs Run Fast, and I've completely forgot Pete McHugh. And about this Wilson incident, and it is quite sad. We're talking about mental health this month, and what's going on in Wilson's mind? You know, I suppose he used to be the best marathon runner in the world by a long shot. He had a year or two when he was the number one.
He's the only man to have beaten Kipchoge in a marathon.
Yeah. And he's slipping away from the top, and he's struggling, and he's in his 30s, getting injuries. He's no longer relevant, really. He still finishes third or fourth in major marathons. So to me, that's, Jesus Christ, that's amazing. But it
wasn't a positive test for a substance. It was something to do with tampering. And his agent, I believe, released a little kind of article about it, or a little press release to say there was a bit more to the story. So everyone was very quick to hang him out to dry, and like it wasn't a test for a substance. Again, with the current rate of positive tests within Kenyan athletes, I'm not holding much hope. I'm not going to stand here and put myself on the line for Wilson, but it read like it's one of the ones where you're looking at I can't remember the actual anti-doping rules that were broken. I think it was like refusing or tampering with a sample, and that can be like anything from, I don't know, like not being able to, like, I don't know, pissing somewhere else when you're supposed to be pissing in your little cup, or kind of just like,
oh really,
it's a whole range of stuff that would come under that. So it'd be interesting to see what more comes from the story. We've not heard anything else. So you've got like Asbel Kiprop, who's kind of violently protesting his innocence on Twitter and stuff, and like making some really weird comments, and that's the kind of man you worry about his mental health. Because if you were innocent, I'm not saying these people are innocent or guilty, but if you were, and it was a wrong, like your whole career suddenly got thrown out the window, like someone like Wilson,
yeah,
over a confusion, yeah, or yeah, then it would be terrifying. But then you hear stories of, what was the one that came out of Kenya a little while ago? People were like literally running over a fence to get away from testers.
Oh, really? Yeah.
So yeah, it wasn't a substance. It wasn't. That's what I don't believe. I don't believe it was a substance found in Wilson's system. It was to deal with the tampering of with a test. I can have a quick peek just because this right. I mean, that's the problem as well, right? In the world of anti-doping, is that the people who really believe in sport, like we want to believe the best in people.
Yeah.
So we kind of like when they say these stories, like, oh no, it wasn't. It wasn't me. It was like the rabbit. There's a rabbit that come into my house and he had some EPO on him. Like, you're like, what? Yeah. Doesn't make any sense. But like, there's a tiny little voice there because you're a half decent person who believes it. Whereas in, like, if you're a doper, you're probably going to tell any kind of lie to get away with it. Or like as in the case in a lot of situations recently, you just sue the anti-doping body for more money than they can afford to lose, and they eventually let you off, and then you claim innocence, and you're like, actually, you just sued the body. So he was. It was whereabouts failure and alleged tampering or attempted tampering. So his people said alleged. We emphasise there's no case of use of doping. No prohibited substance was found. The accusation regarding alleged attempt tampering concerns an explanation that was given the results management process regarding a possible whereabouts failure and does not concern tampering with a doping test. So he's messed up his whereabouts thing, and then the explanation they've given as to what has gone wrong there has been deemed tampering with the anti-doping process. That's what I read from
him. Right, okay.
So he's basically, someone's gone, you weren't there, Wilson. And he's gone, oh, no, I was doing this. And that they've seen that as like he's tampering with the anti-doping process.
Okay. So okay, not that as, makes sense.
The thing is, we've got to be solid with these things. Because if we just start chucking... Like, one thing I'll say about the Kenyan anti-doping thing at the moment is a lot of people getting busted. Right, and everyone's like, yeah, it's because they're all doping. It's nice to see that people are doing their job. And I don't know if that's down to athletics and like anti-doping Kenya, because I mean, you imagine they were doping 5 years ago. So doping now, and it's rife, and they were doping 5 years ago. So all these extra tests that are coming out, well, someone's doing them. Someone's doing their job.
Yeah.
If
following through with prosecutions.
Yeah, and they're, like there's talk in Kenya about making it illegal. So then there'll be even greater consequences for the athletes. Which?
Oh, really?
It's difficult because it changes the level of proof you need for a criminal conviction.
And also, I guess we've had the doping crisis here with the fact that UK anti-doping are not releasing any of Farah's samples to be tested. Even though I guess he's come out and said in his defence, he said he's perfectly happy for any historical samples to be taken.
So UK also said that they haven't actually had a request from WADA for those samples.
Right.
So it was a strange situation. I got quite a bit dismayed by it because the whole thing came out and basically UCAD's chief, Nicole Sapson, said that they wouldn't release an athlete's samples because they don't want to waste, it degrades the sample, and they don't want to waste that sample that they could possibly test with new tests in a couple of years' time. All of these tests have a 10-year statute of limitations. So anything from 2012 in a couple of years' time, doesn't matter if you test it and you find something, it's kind of... So it was a really weird situation. Like, why did they come out and say that? And then they come out after saying, we would assist, but no one's asked us. So it was all a bit weird. And Mo came out on Twitter and said he'd be happy for his to be retested. And it was the, we don't feel the significant evidence to retest. And you're like, well... Like Salazar has been convicted, and his doctor has
quite
been
significant.
Convicted. That's significant evidence. So it was a bit because Jess Judd, she came out and said it was quite outspoken on the matter. I think it's just rare to see athletes come out and speak about it. But
what did she say exactly? She
I can find exactly. Let's have a look. I'm on my laptop, but it's difficult because. One, you can't say anything if you can't prove anything. You don't want to be someone going out there just kind of chucking accusations around. You can't do it. But also, silence is also quite damning. When people won't say anything, or won't talk on the subject. Yeah, the part of them is, it feels like there's an omerta like in cycling, which is very different. But it's quite refreshing to see an athlete speak out.
Yeah.
So it's fine with Jess. It's, but I'm going for it through her retweets. She retweets a lot of American football. She retweeted that she was disappointed in UCAD, the amount of samples that athletes give and why they won't retest, and use stupid excuses as to why. It's embarrassing. Why would people want to keep their data secret? And yeah. why, and you wonder why athletics is dying a drug-fueled death. Hashtag nothing to hide. And that got that was retweeting yeah. from Cara Goucher about the situation. And then UCAD did come back and yeah. say, because there was another thing about, I can't pronounce his name, the German journalist, Hajo Spildelt, or whatever his name, I can't remember, I don't know how you say his name, I really apologise for that. But yeah, they said, well, there was a video of a doctor saying that a British athlete had used EPO, he'd given EPO to a British athlete. And people asked him, had UCAD ever got in contact? And he said, no, they never got in contact with me about the footage. So then they asked UCAD and they said they did an actual, we went out to Kenya, did an investigation, and they shared a Daily Mail article that spoke about the investigation, which was a bit strange. I mean, the Daily Mail is a horrible rag, but their sports sections yes. and their sports journalists are extremely good journalists. That's what I've, as personal opinion, yeah. I wouldn't read the front of the paper, yeah. but I would look at the back pages online. And
yeah.
It spoke about that UCAD had done an investigation and spoke about the three athletes and had decided not that nothing untoward was going on. But then it's just that it's that lack of transparency. I think that's what people struggle with.
Yeah.
We don't know what's yeah. going on there. Like, why, if there's been, if nothing's going on, then you kind of talk about it, all right, and have a kind of like a
yeah
a statement. Just
yeah just to shut all the speculation down. But
yeah,
anyway. So we shouldn't get too deep into this.
Yeah, no. Start it's, that it's, point and not expect me to go wild.
Yeah. But we are going to be talking about mental health today, and we were going to talk about a couple of guys that you know that did a quite incredible challenge running across Scotland.
Couple. I think there was a few of them. Yeah, there's, couple. There's, Paul Giblin, who's a coach up in Scotland, an ultra runner. He has the team Pylon, which is a lot of his athletes, and they did. It was the Scottish National Trial. Right up from the top of the country down to the south of Scotland. And I think it was, yeah. I'm going to get the numbers wrong here, probably 540 miles. And they did it as a relay in winter. I think it was 8 or 9 of them. And they did it in just over 100 hours. So they were shifting. It's been all over my social media this week. And they're doing it to raise money for the Scottish Association for Mental Health. They did take on the West Highland Way last year. So we got a recording from James Stewart, who's one of the athletes who took part.
Let's play it now.
Okay.
The idea of the challenge was to raise awareness and funds for what is commonly recognised as the most challenging month of the year for mental health. For us as a team, what was most humbling was the stories we heard firsthand in the course from people out there with us, people who just come to support, who would then tell us how the endeavour affected them personally. Everyone from people on the course running alongside us to bed and breakfast we might have stayed at as part of the run south, or in some cases random strangers just popping up in the middle of the night just to cheer us on, hand over donuts and burritos. Sometimes the most profound impacts we have are unseen, the people who don't tell you the stories, but they should never be forgotten in the round, and this is where things like the Endeavour make a difference. We are immensely proud to support Scottish Association for Mental Health and the work they do, and you can donate over at our Just Giving page or via the website at www.pylonultra.com.
Yeah, that was James Stewart, one of Team Pylon, and if you can donate to their cause, like the links on their Just Giving page or just for the Scottish Association for Mental Health in general, the boys are doing some really fantastic stuff. And as they say, January is one of the is spoke about as one of the darkest months for people suffering with depression. For a number of reasons. I don't actually know. Yeah. I think it's because there's not much daylight, is there? And
no.
After the
excitement, I think it's all the pressure of Christmas.
Packets are empty.
And it's all. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, it's a tough one. And now we're going to talk about mental health. It's been a difficult subject. Given that we're not experts on it, it's quite a difficult subject for us to give much authority on. But I think what we know, and I guess a lot of people know, is that we know that exercise and we know that running can be good for your mental health, and regular exercise has various effects on the structure of the brain. Obviously, there's new research looking into how it impacts you. It's obvious the benefits of it. And I guess lately we've seen a bit of a stigma change around mental health. It's being more seriously considered nationally by sort of various government bodies and stuff. It's more in the press these days, the importance of it to people. So the talk about exercise has been heightened. There's more people, I guess. I think it's might even be within the NHS, it might exercise might be a do they call it a frontline not diagnosis, but it's recommended as a way to deal with depressive symptoms, which is quite that's quite a major step, really, to use exercise in that way. But for us now, I guess there's no point. Everyone listening to this podcast knows that, but we all know it's a non a relaxed attitude to running and a regular training regime is great for your mental health. There's no point us talking about the benefits and that sort of thing, because everybody listening to this can understand that. I guess the couple of things that I thought were interesting, there was one which is, and I guess was kind of linked to our last episode, which was the interview with Adam Kirk-Smith and his problems with his mental health issues around the time when he was a elite athlete, is that there was a study in the British Medical Journal in 2017 that looked at elite athletes compared to non-athletes and the likelihood of developing depressive symptoms and tendencies. And there was no difference in between these two groups. So it doesn't matter how much running you're doing, you can suffer from depression. And these guys you see at the top of the tree are just like you. They'll also suffer from issues that bring them to, you know, mental health, bad mental health. So I thought that was really interesting. And I guess the other thing is really interesting is, like, we all know it's really, it's something that would help us. We all know that exercise is important, but I don't really know if things got bad for me, if my mental health took a turn for the worse, which it potentially could. I don't know where I go for help, really. I don't know my first sort of course of action in terms of what I would do. And also, like, secondly, like, how would you encourage somebody you know has got poor mental health, someone you know is suffering from depression or any other kind of mental health illness, how would you persuade them to exercise? It's quite a difficult thing. And so what do you think? For you, would you know if you were suffering or if you knew a friend was suffering, would you know where to start in terms of seeking help?
I suppose, like, for me personally, I've got a few friends who have issues with mental health. And it's something I'm a bit intrigued about. And in a way that I'd love to understand it a bit more. And I think it's just, yeah. I look at it as a spectrum. You've got either end of this scale. And you can, if you're depressed, you're at the bottom end of this scale. But you can also, and I've seen with some people, it's kind of waves up and down. And yeah. If you're feeling really depressed, but then the next week you're feeling really high, it kind of means that you're on a wave and you're going to come back crashing down again. And for some people, it's about not going too far with it all. What you said about the elite athletes, it's like the running and the exercise becomes your life. And that's sometimes when that's taken away, that's when that problem can happen. If there's injury, if there's pressure for outside pressures, yeah. I think if you're a person yourself and you feel like you're potentially suffering about it, talk about it. I think is the best thing, and it may be to friends, family. As we said before the call, I think you can pop down to the GP and say your question. If you're talk to them, say, oh, I'm feeling about I might be depressed. Well, again, we don't know enough about the subject. Like, I do know it's one of the biggest killers of young men in the UK.
And that was what was interesting about that study of those elite athletes. It was the male athletes or males in general are way less likely to report mental health conditions than females, which is, as you say, interesting.
Yeah, I think you just try and shoulder it and crack on and think it's just normal to feel a bit down every now and again. I don't think for a minute I've suffered from depression, but I feel like on a smaller level, my mood will go up and down, depending on a variety of factors. But at the moment, I'm not running at all. But it's for me, I feel down not because I'm not running, but because I'm without a goal or a focus. It's harder for me to. I love to plan stuff and to look ahead and to kind of be working towards something. And at the moment, I can't do that, and I feel a little bit lost, a little bit aimless. And that
yeah.
That makes my motivation suffers. And at that point, yeah. You think, okay, well, my motivation's a bit lower. I'm not going to get out for that run, or I'm not going to go and do this, or I'm just going to kind of close away a bit and not speak to people. And then that, yeah, is that the how it starts? Is that a very light level of, again, my mood? I'm not depressed, but it feels like the mood has been slightly depressed in the kind of as a verb, like it's kind of pushed down. It's not as high as it has been in the past. And you think, yeah, is that a very small scale of it? And like as an ultra runner, after races, I get the post-race blues. And like when I first did a 24-hour race, for like 3 or 4 days afterwards, I just couldn't stop crying. Like anything I watched, like if I put Cool Runnings on the telly, that was it. I was crying for the whole day. But like something like an advert had come on, it was a bit sad, and I'd be like, why the fuck am I crying? Sat on the sofa with my dad's, like recovering my legs. That was weird because it wasn't like something I could control. It felt like it was part of my body just kind of kicking back. And that, again, comes into the elite athletes. You push your body and your mind to quite hard limits. But it's not just running that does that. It's looking at all walks of your life. If you're working hard, not fueling properly, not sleeping properly, kind of burning the candle at both ends, then your body and your mind is going to suffer. And it's looking after yourself.
Yeah.
Just, I don't know.
And also the thing with that is it's a circle. So I don't know if I've ever had depression, but I think I've certainly felt at times, probably, maybe I have, in terms of I always want to hark back to days when I was fitter and younger and not necessarily younger, but when I was running really well. And in the last couple of years, I'm trying to claw at the success I can't reach anymore. And I find it hard, but then I try extra hard to, I don't know, take on more training. I try to get lighter. I try and do those things that I think are going to put me back on that pedestal. And it's just, I'm chasing a dream that's either gone or I'm working too hard to get there and I'm putting myself in a hole. And then that then makes you sort of the lack of sleep and the not fueling yourself correctly then fuels the depression, and you get worse and worse and worse and fall further and further into it. But it's hard to recognize it because, I don't know, it's not that big a part of my life, but I feel like I'm bigger than that in a way. I feel like I can easily, I can pull myself out of it. Don't worry about it. It's only running. I'm not that bothered about it. I'll be fine. But actually, it kind of eats away at you and gnaws away at you. And it does make a huge impact on how you feel in the rest of your life. So it takes quite a brave person to say, hang on, actually the cycle that I'm on is one that's leading me down the wrong path. And I think one interesting article I just remembered that someone within the world of running has written was Andy Bradley. Hmm. Have you read stuff that he's written? So he's now the presenter of he certainly runs the Running Channel on YouTube. So lots of videos on there that you can go and have a look at. But I remember he wrote about his struggles with depression after his end of his career. He continued wanting to make a comeback, but he just suffered from injury after injury after injury. And he talks about his identity being wrapped up in being a runner and just not being able to fulfill that anymore, and the depths to which he fell because of that. And it's an interesting read. I'm not sure if it's still around online. I'll try and put a link to it on the show notes. But it's hard to acknowledge that it's a problem. Do you know, it is hard to say, to step off the wheel and say, hang on, I need to take a break, step back from this, because it's just a hobby. But at the same time, it does make such an impact on our lives.
It's definitely a difficult subject to talk about and to feel like to self-diagnose or to try and relate to people, that, because I think it goes much deeper than feeling a bit down every now and again because your running's not going to plan. I think it's a medical issue. So it's a really hard one to talk about as someone who hasn't. I haven't. I mean, Andy Bradley, which is the Parkrun world record holder. I mean, when you've been to those heights, and it's that social identity. How, like a lot of runners, they don't just. It's not just going out and training. It becomes your social life. The park run or the club run. It's your social life. And when you take that away, not only say you're injured, you not only you not getting that enjoyable kind of physical output of running, you're also shut off from your friends, from your support network. You're not going to races, yeah. Your goals have gone out the window. And I suppose it's about making sure that you've got a lot more going on in your life and not focusing it all on one thing. And it's...
Yeah, you're not defined by results. You're not defined by what you do.
Just by your sport.
On the park.
Like it's,
but yeah, by your sport as well.
Is there other things about you? Like there's certain people, we all know, like the only thing we know about them is their running. Like that's it, it's their life, right? And if that went away, there would be nothing else. And then I suppose, like for me, I work as a coach. I write as an editor for Fast Running. I run myself. Running is a huge part of my life. And I have to kind of actively make sure that there are other things going on in my life that aren't running related, because at the moment I can't really run. See, like you think I'm quite up for like just kind of feeling a bit lost with it all. But making sure that I've got other things going on, and like it's a difficult one. I find it really difficult to talk about because I don't want to say something that's basically incorrect. If you're worried about a friend, I think that's the best thing we can say is if someone's worried about a friend, just talk to them, chat to them, be there, ask them how they are, but just look out. If we all look out for each other, all right. If there's someone you haven't heard from for a while. Or if they're normally posting every day on Instagram or Twitter and they're not on there at the moment, just drop them a message. Ask them how things are going.
Yeah.
I think that's the best thing we can do as individuals. I don't know advice for people that have got depression or suffering from depression. I'm not going to say go down to park run and sign up because that might not be the right thing for someone. But if you're worried about a friend, just check in with them. Ask them how they are. Give them a call. Go around and see them. Meet them for coffee.
Yeah.
Like if there's someone not running and they're injured and you know they've been out of action for a while, go down the pub with them. Maybe not. I think booze would probably be like too much of that can also add to the issue. But that can also help you as an individual, helping others. One, like, I was just doing some reading before we popped on like a bit of Googling and like it was like, look after a pet. It was one of the bits of advice. I'm not saying you should buy a new puppy, right? That sounds like a terrible idea and a commitment just because you're feeling like a bit down 1 week. You have millions of dogs by the end of the year. But if you can check someone's all right, just be there for your mates and it gives you a purpose. Like it can help you kind of add a bit of something to your life if you're...
There's a couple of things I was going to mention with regard to that. Like there was, I used to be part of a project. I used to in London when I lived back over there called a Good Gym.
Yeah.
So I used to run a couple of branches over there, and for me, that's a really you talked about there helping other people makes you feel better about yourself, and that's a really good project to be involved with because essentially it's they try and mix running and physical volunteering with helping other people. So they meet every week in different areas. I think they're almost all the way across the UK now. And you go down for a group run once a week and you'll run to an enterprise or a project or a charity or a school or something somewhere in your borough or your county or wherever else that needs help with a physical task. So we did a variety of things from digging sandpits, so making sandpits, to painting youth centres, to a whole vast array of different things. But the main thing was you were trying to do a group that needed it with help that you could provide quite easily with a huge group of runners. So you'd run there, you'd do the task, you'd run back. And that was great because, I mean, you get out, you're exercising, but more importantly, you're with other like-minded people in your area. You're getting to meet different people who live sort of quite close by you, who wouldn't ordinarily bump into. But you're doing something good for other people. So it's really like it matches three things that immediately give you like a boost to your own self-esteem. So I'd recommend if anyone has a chance to do that sort of thing, and they do need runners to join in and help out, do that. Give it a try. And the other even more interesting thing that they do, which is it's a bit more of a commitment, but again, it's a lovely thing to do, is they try and match you. You have to go through a CRB check, that sort of thing, with an elderly person in your or within running distance of your home. So what you do once a week is on one of your runs, this is the idea, you will run to that person who hasn't got any family necessarily or doesn't have a lot of friends or anyone to keep them company. You'll run around, you might drop them around a newspaper, but you just pop in for a 10-15 minute chat and then run off. And again, that's really good because you're giving them social interaction, which they wouldn't ordinarily get. They might be seen by a social worker once a week, but that's kind of the only thing that they get to do. So you're helping them, but also it's good because it's forcing you, it's giving the motivation for you to get out and run. So it's a double win, really. It's a really nice project.
I like the second. I think we should do that. People should do that with their own families as well. How many times have you got like friends and family that you don't go and visit every night, but you could just go run around there? And like I have this thing, I used to think if it takes you longer to travel somewhere than the time you're visiting someone, it shows a commitment. Like if it takes you an hour to get somewhere and you're only seeing someone 15 minutes, part of you might think, well, it's not worthwhile. But actually, you've run a whole hour to get there. All right, you're a bit sweaty when you get there. And then you've seen them, chat. You're like, it's a nice thing to do. It makes that person feel valued. I've been part of a good gym. Sometimes I see the pictures and it does look like a bunch of people who are solely doing it to make themselves feel better rather than tell the people that they're supposed to be helping. But
even that's fine, right? Do you know what I mean? A lot of these people, I mean, I hope they don't mind me saying it, but a lot of the people certainly used to come along to the area up in, I used to do, I think some of them are quite lonely people. Yeah. And it was actually just the act of coming along to join a group up in London and have a bit of a run with everyone, it was good for them too. Like, and it was helping their mental health too, because obviously they had people, like-minded people with them, young people around the same age. So although it's like you're trying to, you know, you're doing it to say you're great in a way, but it's really good because it's for some of those people, it's like it's the thing that they build their lives around. And I think that was really nice. So
yeah, I think as a coach, sometimes like you give people a plan, right? And this is like the ideal plan to train for X marathon, X ultra marathon. And you forget to add in other aspects like the club run. So when I started coaching, I'd say, this is what you do every week. This is how you should do it. This is the best way to train for this race. And I'd forget to put like the social club run on a Thursday or club runs, you've got smash yourself to pieces on a Tuesday. And whilst it might not be best for the athlete to go there every Tuesday and like batter their body doing 200 meter reps when they're training for an ultra, that if to remove that social element of it completely as a coach, you're not doing the best things for your athlete. So I think it's important to value the social part of running, because it can be very like me personally. I got one chap I run with around where I live, and I will make sure he'd be like, "Do you want to run tonight?" And I'm thinking, my plan says to do this, and I know he's a younger lad, he's a bit quicker, and I'm like, right, this is going to be another steady run, steady to like threshold kind of effort. Threshold at the moment, unfortunately. But I know it's important for me to go out and run with someone else. We better, I just speak in English quite loudly and he just nods most of the time. And then I say the odd word in Italian. I'm pretty sure his English is good enough to know what I'm saying, but maybe not all the time when I just go off on one. But I know that it's an important part for me. And I think he enjoys the motivation. I like to think at least he's practicing his English or gets to run with someone. We're around the same level over the half marathon, and that's his top end, and that's my low end of racing. So I think it's important to respect the social elements of running. We had the loneliness of the long distance runner, but it can be a very social activity, and to take that away from part of your running, or if you move somewhere new or you don't speak the language when you're somewhere, it can make it a bit more of a lonely experience, especially if you're putting in some serious mileage.
Yeah, and I certainly think that's been hard for me this over here in Amsterdam. I don't have the same group of friends I had over in London, and because having a child, you don't have as much time anymore, so you just got to just run whenever you get the window. So I think it's been something I've actually got to force myself to do and arrange runs to go and
join a local club.
Make sure I'm chatting to people.
Try and get to one.
Yeah, I've got to. Yeah, and we should mention England Athletics have often, I think on previous episodes, I guess on the diversity show, we gave them a bit of a beating, I think, to an extent. But a little bit, I feel bad about it, because I mean, like, to a certain extent, they're only people doing their best, and you know, that no one wants to, you know, make mistakes and get things wrong, and I don't want to slag them off too badly, because I'm sure there's things that I'm doing badly. But with this, with depression and things, and with mental health, they are trying, and they've got an initiative called Run and Talk.
Okay.
So they are working hard at putting sort of mental health champions within clubs and within regions that where people can come and sort of talk to them about their various issues. And they have a week where they'll set various runs up where people can go to runs and chat to different people. So I think they are focusing on mental health.
I've got a lot of time for England Athletics. I know there's a lot of keyboard worries out there, but I don't know if it's very easy to pick fault and not know the bureaucratic like issues that people are facing. And it's a massive, like, recovery's a massive area of huge amount of runners, so I'm willing to give them the I know there are a lot of people who say that, like, there's people online saying they should be scrapped, and you think, what? And then you're going to take over and do the job instead. Like, yeah, good one, mate. Like, within about a week, the building will be on fire, you moron. So, like, it just makes me think people don't appreciate, like, how many meetings you probably got to go in to discuss, I don't know, like, the rule 17.43 about, like, length of pants you can wear during a race and stuff like this. And, we've got our sport is built on volunteers. Like, definitely in the UK, there's a huge amount of volunteers, but a lot of time in to make it work. And these are people paid at the top of the pile, trying to, like, encourage more volunteers and trying to organise things. But there should be more people, like, doing those jobs. And if they were working in bigger industries, if they're in banking, these same people might be getting a lot more money. It's not that a lot of people involving in England Athletics aren't doing it for the cash. They're doing it because they love the sport. Yeah. You've got to get that kind of battering. And you see them go on some of the Facebook groups and, like, they've tried engaging, and you just get like absolutely venomous attacks. Vitriol. Yeah, and you just, how do you respond to that? You can't, it's not, at that time, you could be spending that time working on a new initiative. Like, it sounds like the mental health one, it sounds like a good idea. It sounds like a nice program. Yeah. Like, and but it requires work. Or you could spend that time on social media, talking to a runner,
responding to your detractors.
So
crazy.
I know. Yeah. Just that feels like it's just one sided. I'm going to stick up for Netflix a little bit. I mean, I have enough. I part of the management team for the 24-hour squad for British Athletics, and it's hard getting stuff out of that at the moment because there's a lot of change going on there. So I'd probably focus more. Yeah. I don't know why British Athletics get less of a battering than England Athletics. They're the governing body. They're the big dogs. England Athletics are the ones below. Yeah. Like, surely we should attack the top of the tree. I don't know. Is that like?
Yeah.
Is that
they do. If you look on, I was or am a runner. I think British Athletics get a bit of
a battering too.
A hammering there. Yeah. It's not consigned to England Athletics. But,
Scottish Athletics get off all right. Old Ian Beattie is in the group. I like Ian. He does a lot of good work up there. The Scottish Athletics do a lot.
We chatted to Ian's previous interviewee on the show back in the day. Yeah. Good guy.
Good runner, mate. It's good people.
Well, we better get on and enjoy the day.
Yeah.
It's time for us to go and do something else. But it's been nice chatting. And we'll try and hook up again. This is your last podcast for a month.
Oh, mate. I was relying on this to keep me sane.
Back and forth.
Just enjoyed a nap. Can we call up next month for me and you to chat and not record it?
Yeah, let's just do it. Yeah. We'll do that instead. Hopefully I'll be back racing then as well. I can fill you in on how my next 10K goes.
I don't want to know about your racing. I can't race, right? Tell me about like your days off and your rest days and how they were really tough. That's what I want to hear about because I can't bloody race at the moment. My wife raced though.
Yeah.
She did her first half marathon.
Oh, yeah.
And
how did she get on?
She ran 1:28, which we were pleased with. And she had her first anti-doping test in about 30 years of, like, international running. She's run for GB in England.
Wow.
She's never been anti-doping tested.
No.
So, first experience ever.
Did she win the race?
No, she was just seventh. Like, I was laughing. We were laughing about it. I was like, I mean, if we were doping, right, at 1:28, I was really pleased. It was a great run for her. She's a trail mountain runner, so she's not used to running on the roads. Paced it fantastically. Yeah. But 1:20, if you're doping and running 1:28, then you're doing that wrong, aren't you? And it weren't even money. We won cheese. Like, I don't even like Gorgonzola. So, like, it was for her first doping test to be at a race where there's no prize money. She ran decent, finished seventh, right? And the winner was 1:20, which for women's half is a good time. Men's winner was just under 70 minutes. It's a good time, but it's not doping level, is it? Jesus.
No,
if you're a geezer and you're doping and you're running 70 minutes flat, then you're doping wrong.
Yeah.
Right? Wilson got it right by the sounds of it. He was running 2:03 or something. Was interesting. Took it like it was a interesting setup, and it just a little rural race in Italy. But yeah, so Natalie's racing. I'm really pleased about that. She's got more coming up.
What's she aiming for this winter? Has she got any big ideas?
We are trying to get her back into a race called the Tour de Gens, which is a 338-kilometre mountain race in the Aosta Valley in Italy.
Wow.
She's run it before. She finished ninth female in 118 hours, which is just under 5 days, and she wants to go faster. And I think she definitely can. She's learned a lot since then. So that's the goal.
Wow.
And
Jesus.
Yeah,
I can't do anything for that long.
Well, you can, mate. Basically you do you do life for 5 days. Life becomes running even more. And after things like that, I know I've waffled on now. You were trying to bring it to a close, but after big things like that, the post race blues. And I've been reading a lot about reading this book by a lady called Emily Chappell, who talks about the transcontinental bikepacking races, and she speaks a lot about depression in there. And there's a very inspiring man called Mike Hall, who passed away a few years ago, died in a bike race, and talks about him a lot in there. And he keeps popping up because they're trying to. He's got a legacy that they're continuing on, and he just sounds like a fascinating man. So that, like, it's first time I've read about someone and thought, I wish I could have met him. But he talks about he set the record for cycling around the world, just like unsupported, so on your own. And after that, apparently, it took months just to get back to normal. So just kind of fighting a lot of, and just be it, like, even in like Emily's book, she talks about crying whilst you're in the race and stuff, and she used to think it was a sign of weakness, but actually it's okay, it's all right to shed a tear. It's kind of just a natural thing. But that's a really good book, Emily Chappell's book. I'd highly recommend it.
Okay, I certainly have noticed, this is going off on another tangent, since I've become a dad, I'm crying at all sorts of stuff. It's crazy. I think I watched this. Have you seen this program, Giri Haji? Oh, it's on Netflix now. British crime.
I've gone over it, not actually clicked on it.
God, it's really good. But I was having a good cry to that last night. So
do you think as a stay-at-home dad that your estrogen levels would have raised?
I'll
be sure to check that. I wonder if I'm going to look for a study now, just to send it to you afterwards.
Yeah, lovely. Right, well, we head off.
Yeah, let's go. Let's get to chat. We'll talk about something random again.
Cheers, Robbie.
Cheers, bye.